From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sadly, on cue, another wave of violence and crackdown has washed across Israel and the Palestinians' occupied territories. Five bloody suicide bombings in 2 days. Israeli troops clamping down. The message, the so-called roadmap to peace, may be another dead end. In a moment, Israeli historian and journalist Tom Segev joins us with a wish for hope and a dose of reality. Tonight on Point, a roadmap to peace, realities on the ground, and the requirements of an impatient world. We begin in Jerusalem, where New York Times Jerusalem correspondent James Bennett has been covering the recent spate of Palestinian suicide bombings in Israel and political developments on the latest plan for Israeli-Palestinian peace. Earlier, I asked him to describe President Bush's conversations today with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon.
Well, it was his first conversation with the new Palestinian Prime Minister, Abu Mazen, and partly I think they were trying to get a sense of each other. President Bush was trying to signal that he remained committed to this new international peace plan known as the roadmap, and he was trying to push Abu Mazen to be enacting against the groups that have been conducting the terrorist bombings we've seen in the last couple of days, including a suicide bombing at a mall in northern Israel yesterday. With Prime Minister Sharon, he was delivering condolences for the Israeli victims of those attacks and was also restating his support for the same peace plan, which Mr. Sharon has some very serious reservations about.
James Bennett, how does it sound in Israel today when President Bush conveys that he's confident that this roadmap will yet unfold positively, that he's determined to push ahead? Does it sound realistic? Does it sound out of touch?
There's deep skepticism here on both sides, I would say, both about the roadmap and about the depth of the American commitment to it. A year ago, the Bush administration also made similar noises about achieving peace here. The violence continued, and the special envoy that President Bush had sent here to try to work out an agreement simply disappeared and hasn't been seen really in this region since last May. So they're starting out with some doubts, but President Bush has expressed his commitment in much stronger terms this time around. The peace plan is far more detailed, and for all these reasons, diplomats say that they expect more of a push from Washington now.
What would the elements of such a push be? How can Washington put this back on the rails, keep it on the rails, when you have people dying in Israel's suicide attacks and continued Israeli occupation and strengthened occupation in the West Bank and Gaza? What leverage can the United States bring?
The U.S. does have tremendous leverage here, and I think in Washington now they're kind of wrestling with the question for precisely how and still, I think, whether to really bring it to bear. I mean, obviously, the maximum leverage would be for President Bush himself to make a trip here, sit down with the leaders and tell them that he expects action. That's not likely to happen, it doesn't seem. They are talking about appointing another special envoy, taking some step like that. What we still don't know is whether they're willing to really wrestle with the details of bringing both sides along in accordance with this plan or some version of the plan. There have been a lot of statements from the White House about a vision for peace of two states living side by side. The question is whether they're willing to really get down into the details required to make that happen.
And if they were to do that, can they bring something to bear here that Bill Clinton, President Clinton, could not?
Well, the situation is a lot different than when Bill Clinton tried to do it. Worse and, in some ways, more hopeful. Worse in that we've now had more than 31 months of bitter conflict between the two sides. There's the failure of the Clinton-led peace plan that preceded that. All of this has been obviously tremendously disillusioning and embittering for the two sides. On the other hand, people here say they're more realistic about what can be accomplished. They're exhausted by the conflict. They're ready for a change. There's some frustration on the Palestinian side with the endless uprising in the sense that it isn't accomplishing anything for their people. On the Israeli side, the economy is also in a terrible tailspin. They're anxious to do something to try to bring the tourists back, bring the stock market back up again, and peace. Well, neither side will talk anymore about a new Middle East and instant reconciliation. There is the feeling that they're anxious to get back to some kind of normalcy.
We've heard calls just in the last couple of days revived for the expulsion of Yasser Arafat from the West Bank. How serious are these calls?
I'm told by people close to Mr. Sharon that we shouldn't take him too seriously in the short term. The Prime Minister made a commitment to President Bush a couple of years ago now not to harm Yasser Arafat, and he's still honoring that commitment. They're not really sure how they could expel him without doing that. And it's the general recommendation of the security services not to do it because they think that Mr. Arafat could cause more trouble from abroad than he can from his ruined compound in Ramallah, where he's effectively locked up now.
And what about the Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, or Abu Mazen as he's widely known? Does he have the wherewithal to counter the terrorism as the Israelis demand?
Well, this is the question. He has almost no popular support whatsoever. He was reluctantly appointed by Yasser Arafat. He was not elected. And what his allies say is that he does not have that wherewithal if he can't present some tangible political benefit to his people. That is, if he can't show them that there's some progress being made on their concerns, the Israeli restrictions, the growth of Israeli settlements, then he can't hope to really try to stop violence because there'll be too little support for him. From the Israeli side, they say they need to see that he's serious about stopping this violence before they can make any kind of concession, because otherwise they feel they'd simply be providing a reward for terrorism.
But if he doesn't have the means to deliver, unless and until Israel lets him bring some trophy home, that would seem to put it back in Israel's hands.
Well, that's his argument, and this is, again, a fundamental deadlock that's existed between the two sides for more than 2 years, mm-hmm. and is the sort of thing that they're looking to the Bush administration to step in on and resolve.
James Bennett, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
New York Times Jerusalem correspondent James Bennett, he spoke with me from Jerusalem. Five Palestinian suicide bombings in 48 hours are still resonating tonight. Israel's Ariel Sharon has postponed this week's planned trip to meet with George Bush in Washington. Today there was a flurry of calls for the expulsion of Yasser Arafat from the West Bank. President Bush says he will push the roadmap, a step-by-step timetable for peace and a Palestinian state by 2005. Our guest tonight, Israeli journalist and historian Tom Segev, says it's going to take long years to get there. Do we have long years? Can Israel and Palestinians make peace with the leadership triangle of Sharon, Arafat, and Abbas now in place? How much pressure can or should Washington bring to bear on all sides? And has war in Iraq really changed the terms of this conversation or not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Tom Segev, columnist for the Israeli Daily Haaretz, visiting professor of journalism at Northeastern University in Boston, and author of several books on Israel, including One Palestine Complete, Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate, and Elvis in Jerusalem, Post-Zionism and the Americanization of Israel, just released in paperback. It is a terrific pleasure to have you here. Tom Segev, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Tom, we've been reading you and trying to learn at your foot for a long time now. And here, at just the moment after the war in Iraq, after 9/11, when we are all told that peace is absolutely necessary between Israelis and Palestinians for the world to move ahead in anything like an orderly fashion, for terrorism to be addressed, for cultures to be knitted back together, for divides to be bridged. If we read you right, you're saying, slow down, settle down. The roadmap is a mirage, and it's not going to happen on anything like this timetable. Your message doesn't jive with what we're told we need to have now. Does that matter, or is this just going to go ahead on a timetable of its own very slow nature?
We always needed peace. That's not new. It was always very difficult to get it. I think that we were on the road to peace during the days of Oslo. Oslo, I think, was mismanaged. I would go back to the Oslo process tomorrow morning. The principle was that it's a very slow process, and it's based on interim agreements. It's based on what can be achieved at the time. And that is not something somebody can plan in Washington. I think it's naive to assume that by the year 2005, the conflict will be gone. The conflict cannot be solved at this time, unfortunately. It can be only managed. We can hope to manage it in a more rational way than we have managed it so far. But I don't think that we already have a solution to the problem of the Palestinian refugees. We don't have a solution to the problem of the settlements. And we don't have a solution to the problem of Jerusalem. But these are all problems which can be managed. And I think that it is about managing the conflict, not about solving it. So the good thing about the roadmap is that it does say what everybody knows to be the probably the solution to the conflict. That is to say, two-state solution, there will be two states, Israeli state, Palestinian state, some kind of power sharing in Jerusalem. Everybody knows what's going to happen. But it's very, very difficult to get there, and I think it takes many more years than the roadmap assumes.
But the whole point of the roadmap, and this, of course, drawn up by the so-called quartet, the United States, the UN, Russia, and the EU,
right,
was that not only that it would lay down a series of goals, but that it would have a timetable. And it seemed to be drawn up in recognition of the fact that Israelis and Palestinians left to their own devices would be sort of perpetually stalemated. Wasn't the idea to bring pressure to bear from outside, nearly to impose a timetable, or to suggest it so strongly with such leverage that both parties would feel obliged to one way or another go along? Is that just wishful thinking?
Well, but there is no very strong pressure. That's, of course, because you know, it seems to me as if the people in Washington really worked out. You know, they did an easy job. It was easy for them. They wrote up a paper, and now they say, okay, you want it, take it. You don't want it, don't take it. But it really needs a lot of pressure to do it. The roadmap requires very little from Israel and offers very little to the Palestinians.
Now, let's stop right there for a moment. Doesn't it require, it seems to me, a lot from Israel? If you take it just as it's written, mm-hmm. it requires from Israel that it move ahead in granting early pieces of sovereignty to the Palestinians,
right,
simultaneous with the Palestinian effort to end terrorism. That, at least as described by Ariel Sharon, is a lot to ask of Israel, more perhaps than he's willing to give.
Oh, yes, it's more than he's willing to give, but it's not enough to move anywhere, because Israel was already willing to give more than that. Barak was willing to give more than that, and Barak wasn't able to give the Palestinians enough. So the gap is very deep. It's not whether I am for it or against it. It's really trying to analyze the situation and telling you that you have to be realistic about it. The positions are very far apart, and it's very, very difficult. And I think that we need a whole generation of management, which means that we need to dismantle, Israel needs to dismantle small, isolated settlements on the occupied territories, particularly in Gaza, also on the West Bank. Mm. These settlements can be dismantled, and Zionist history will not remember them. They do nothing for the national aims of Israel. They just bring more animosity and more aggravation. And it would be for the Palestinians something which the Palestinians can record as an achievement, because the Palestinians need something to lose, so they need also something to achieve first.
But is that enough to give Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, a kind of foothold here?
That would be a beginning. Mm-hmm. Then I think that the Israelis and the Palestinians should jointly do whatever they can to fight terrorism, which is not
jointly
easy. Yes, but we do have to recognize that not all terrorist attacks can be eliminated. In other words, we have to recognize that we will have to continue to live with terrorism, and we must not allow a 19-year-old suicide bomber to dictate the whole Middle East agenda.
But so far, that seems to be nearly what's happening. Ariel Sharon is not in Washington this week, and of course he was scheduled to be there. We've got to take a short break, Tom Segev. We're talking tonight about the roadmap to peace and realities on the ground in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with Israeli journalist and historian Tom Segev. Tom Segev writes that this peace will take many years. Does the world have years to spare for this conflict? Is the idea of a roadmap naive, or is it wisdom born of necessity? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the roadmap to peace and realities on the ground in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with Israeli journalist and historian Tom Segev. You can join the conversation as well. How should Washington bring pressure to bear on both sides? Can the world afford to wait for Israelis and Palestinians to settle this? Is there another way? And I guess, do Sharon, Arafat, Abbas, and Bush add up to a quartet that can make peace? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom Segev, you've written recently about the Israeli mood, the mood among Israeli people, how only 3 years ago there was a lot of hope still about the Oslo process, and how that has been dashed, crushed, trampled by the violence of the 30-some months since then. And you say that it has brought many people to reevaluate their position. Right. You described sitting in a cafe talking about peace. You walk out of the cafe and the cafe blows up and it makes you feel stupid. You, in the Israeli political spectrum, correct me if you want to put a nuance on this, but I see you as a liberal in that spectrum. You write for Haaretz, a fairly liberal newspaper in Israel. Haaretz, what about you personally and your view of this conflict? Are you still pushing for peace, or are you now, do I hear you sitting back and saying, nope, this is going to take decades?
It is going to take decades, I think, but I'm pushing towards a more rational management of the conflict, which means that we have to take a whole new attitude towards the human rights of the Palestinians, because what we're doing now is really raising a new generation of terrorists rather than putting down terrorism.
You write that Israel constantly violates their most basic human rights and imposes various forms of collective punishment. You say that has to stop, but that has been part of that the so-called management, at least as we've understood management of this problem.
No, I think we have lost our ability and willingness to distinguish between terrorists and between the rest of the population. We punish the whole population as if everybody is a terrorist. Of course, if you see an Arab walking in Israel, you don't know if he's a terrorist or not. So that's they're even disguising us as Jews now. So that's very scary. But we are punishing the whole population, and this is no good. The terror is going on. So I don't think that's the right approach, and that's one of the things we can change. As I said, I think that we can dismantle the at least some of the settlements, and I think that we can work for some kind of Palestinian statehood, and I think the Palestinians should accept some kind of statehood even before the conflict is resolved. So that it's not about solving, as I said before. It's really about making life more livable. So if I were a Palestinian, I would say to my government, take what you can get now. And that doesn't mean that the conflict is over. We can get more sometime later.
Are Israelis politically, psychologically at this point, after all the suicide bombings, prepared to adopt the kind of posture that you're describing here, a little less rough, tough, and clamped down in its instinct, a little more, you describe a kind of gentler management, if that's possible, of this problem?
Israelis are angry. Israelis are frightened. And I think more than anything else, Israelis are confused because they no longer know what to do. This is a vicious cycle, and we don't really know the way out. So I think more than anything else, we are confused. And if you look at the polls which come out of Israel, they are very strange. 70% of all Israelis say, yes, we are for the dismantlement of some settlements, at least. People tell you, no, we think Sharon doesn't know where he takes the country, but they vote for him. He's very popular. And I really think that as long as Sharon leads Israel and as long as Arafat is there as a symbol, nothing much can happen. So we are really wasting time. This is why this is such a tragic time. People lose lives, and we are just, my feeling is that we are just wasting time.
Tom Segev, I want to get a Palestinian voice in here and get your response. I spoke just a couple of hours ago with Saab Erekat, whose recent resignation as Palestinian negotiations minister, of course you know, was accepted by Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas this past weekend. He has seen a lot, as you know, Tom Segev. I asked him to comment on your suggestion that the roadmap is naive in its prescription for peace. And here's what he had to say from Jericho in the West Bank. Saab Erekat.
No, I disagree with Tom. I totally disagree. I think the roadmap is not reinventing the wheel, actually. The roadmap is compiling commitments made between Palestinians and Israelis, compiling offers made by outside parties, and compiling the most strategic Arab move since 1948, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia's initiative to call upon Israel to go into full peace, full normalization in exchange for withdrawal to the Jewish-Christian border. I think the roadmap is divided into three parts. There are many new elements into it, meaning you have the elements of American and European monitors, you have the elements of timelines, you have the elements of end game, specifying the end of occupation, and establishing a Palestinian state. And I think it's doable. To be honest with you, I think it's the only way that we can go ahead. And I think if this roadmap is wasted, God help Palestinians and Israelis. I really don't know.
And do you think, Saber Akat, that it can happen on the timetable as envisioned, with a Palestinian state by 2005?
Yes, sir. I have been one of those who have been to life after peace. In Taba, we drafted three chapters with my Israeli colleagues of the Permanent Status Treaty. Mm-hmm. If there is a political will on both sides, realizing that Israel's right to exist within secure and recognized boundaries, that is the June 4th, 67 boundaries, Palestinian state on the June 4th, 67 boundary, that's 22% of historic Palestine, I believe it's doable. The rest of the issues are doable. And it doesn't need that much time, actually. If you can kick off the negotiations and resume them where we left off in Taba, I've been to life after peace. It's doable, and it will happen one day.
And can it happen with this triangle of leaders, Arafat, Abbas, Sharon?
That's a good question, honestly. I think it's easier for the Pope to cancel a Christmas Mass than for Sharon to accept the roadmap. The roadmap calls for a total cessation of settlement activities, including the so-called natural growth, and calls upon Sharon, if he accepts it, to go out and say, I recognize a Palestinian state, I stop all violence against Palestinians, and I stop incitement against Palestinians. I don't think he will do it. I think he will hide behind bilateral meetings with Palestinians. I think he will hide behind the presidential elections coming soon to President Bush. And he will hide behind the needs to continue the settlement activities. Unfortunately, we need a third party now. I think Israelis and Palestinians are at their lowest point of trust. And that's why I left my job as a negotiator with a broken heart, because I realized that we cannot do it at this stage. We need a third party. We need President Bush to come in and introduce the timeline, the mechanisms of implementation, the monitors, and say to us, Palestinians, you are in your corner, Israelis, you are in your corner, and we're watching you. And we will vouch who's doing and who's not doing. That's the key word.
But, Saber, can that happen when suicide bombings go on? Many deaths just over the past weekend and couple of days. Can these bombings be stopped by the Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen, by the Palestinian Authority?
We want to stop suicide bombing, and we condemn suicide bombing, and we condemn the killings of innocent Palestinians. There have been 55 Palestinians killed in the last 18 days, and there are 12 Israelis killed in the last 5 days. So if we say that, can you have a peace process without stopping suicide bombing? Can you stop suicide bombing while we have continuing with this situation of despair and occupation and settlements and violence from both sides? This is why we urgently need to revive hope in the minds of Palestinians and Israelis. This is why we need to talk. This is why we need the intervention of a third party. So if we can hide behind that this wave of suicide bombing will prevent peace process, on the contrary, because they continue to happen after Sharon occupied the West Bank, because it continues to happen after Sharon failed through his military solutions, this is why we need a meaningful resumption of a peace process that will get into the minds of Palestinians and Israelis that peace is doable. And we should do it now. And if we don't do it, we're just going to say to ourselves, it's the tip of the iceberg out there. It's my children and my friends in Israel's children who are the candidates to be going soon to another world. And we need to give them life. We need to give them hope. And I don't know of any other way other than a meaningful peace process that will lead to ending Israeli occupation and establishing a Palestinian state next to Israel as stipulated in the roadmap.
Saber Akat, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Former Palestinian negotiations minister Saber Akat, he spoke with me from Jericho. Tom Segev, I want to get your response as an Israeli listening on to what you've just heard about the overall perspective there, the clear embrace of the roadmap on Saber Akat's part.
Right.
Of course, it's complex.
Right.
And in particular, his notion that, hey, let's just pick up where we left off at Taba. We were so close. Let's look past these past 30 months and get back to where we were at Taba.
Okay. I think that when you interview a minister mm-hmm. on the Palestinian side, you should interview an Israeli official spokesman on the Israeli side.
Because, well, we've had many. We have you tonight.
I know, but I'm
not an official.
Right. So if I were an official spokesman, I would probably express as much hope as possible and tell you that first terrorism must stop. And once terrorism stops, we are very hopeful and everything will be nice. And we will head for peace and my children and his children and all these cliches, which he
easy to say
repeats so very nicely. Mm-hmm. And I just don't believe it. And I think that if you hear the first part of Arakat's statement saying how the road map can work, and then you hear how Sharon won't do it, so it doesn't work. But it's not only Sharon. It's also the Palestinians. If the Palestinians think that all Israeli settlements can be dismantled, they are wrong. They cannot. The situation has changed since 1967, and I think it's not realistic to lead a discussion as if we are still in 1967. I think I agree with Saeb Arakat on one point, and that is that it's very necessary for somebody from outside to intervene. We really need a very strong involvement of the United States. And I also think that Europe can play a very important role. For example, if we get ahead with the idea that Israel will become full member of the European Union, that is something that might tell many Israelis, wow, it's really worthwhile trying something new. And that is an idea, which is not my own idea. I mean, it's floating in the air that Israel will become member of the European Union and in exchange for that. So that's a possibility. Also, with Iraq gone, one threat is gone.
So that was supposed to kind of break open the situation here and make new things possible.
I know, but it really didn't, because the conflict between us and the Palestinians is really not only on living conditions and borders and security. It's a very, very deep rooted conflict. It has emotional aspects and religious aspects. It's about myth. It's about history. It's much deeper than anything somebody in some office in Washington can plan to solve with all good will.
Tom Segev, stand by. I want to invite our callers in tonight. Nicholas Steve is calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a question for Mr. Segev about the Likud party's arguments that settlements are necessary in part in the West Bank for security reasons. In particular, the West Bank needs to be occupied by Israel and settled by Israel to make it thicker to counter threats like Iraq. And, of course, with Iraq gone now, predictably, I think the Likud party will switch to other rationales. But one enduring rationale is that the settlements need to be there, at least some of them, for Israel's security. And I wonder what Mr. Segev thinks of that. I've always thought of it as the settlements as a net security burden, not an asset, because of the need to defend the settlers. Could you ask him to speak to that, please?
Absolutely, Steve. Thanks for your call. Tom Segev.
Yes, I agree with you. I also don't think that the Likud party very often uses the security argument anymore, because everybody knows that the settlements are in fact a security hazard. They need lots and lots of soldiers to guard them, and I also don't happen to think that they bring us any closer to the fulfillment of the Zionist dream. They do not, because they are located in the midst of a hostile population, in contrast to the historical policy of the Zionist movement, which always preferred empty land to populated areas. And I think that Steve is right. But I also don't think that they can be undone. You must realize that some of these settlements are big towns now, and so they cannot be undone.
So, in fact, everything is reduced to facts on the ground, and that's it? That's the way it is?
No, some settlements can be dismantled. Mm-hmm. About 100,000 settlers can be brought home. Mm-hmm. And I think that they should be welcome when they return home. They should get compensation everything you can solve with money, I think, is the easiest way to solve, and so that's easy. But some of these settlers are there for ideological reasons, and some settlers don't regard themselves as settlers anymore.
But could Israel bring home enough settlers to make the topography of settlement tolerable to the Palestinians?
Over time, the Palestinians will have to recognize it. Yes, it will be a difficult reality, but the more time passes, the more settlers move in. No settlers move out.
And in the meantime, to Steve's point, you're saying, well, there isn't exactly a rationale security, or at least in your view, in terms of the Zionist dream. It's simply that there are people who live there, and it's a reality
of life. Many of them just live there, and not for ideological reasons. Mm-hmm. And many of them live there for ideological reasons. I don't think that anybody lives there in order to, or that anybody kids himself that he is living there in order to protect the security of Israel. It's either because it's nice to live there.
Cheaper
it's,
rent.
Cheaper, and it's quality of life, and it's an adventure, and, you know. And many live there for ideological reasons. These are religious fanatics and national fanatics, and so it's very, very difficult to get them out.
Let's get one more call before the break. Nicholas is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Nicholas. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
I have a couple of short and related comments.
Be quick, Nicholas.
I'll do my best. You cut me off if you need to. The first is about the simplistic picture that the press in this country and what we hear from comments from people in Israel draw. The picture is a stereotype of Palestinians as kind of united as the one with the terrorists. Israelis call them animals. I've certainly heard that a few times, which hardly allows for a compromise. And Sharon treats terrorist attacks as an excuse to draw to destroy Palestinian social institutions.
And do you have a second point, Nicholas, or is that it?
Well,
our time's running.
Okay, the second point is that there will always be individuals and interests that are empowered by violence, and they will continue to commit acts of violence. The important thing is to divide the groups, support Palestinians who are willing to deal, and to continue to move on in the context of violence.
Nicholas, let me take it there. Tom Segev, this issue of stereotyping.
I agree with you on the second point, and I think that there is a problem with stereotypes. Not all Israelis call all Palestinians animals, mm-hmm. but obviously we lose a lot of our liberal good manners when we blow up in buses. So that's one problem. And, of course, the Palestinians... the Palestinian incitement against not only Israelis but also Jews is a very, very big problem.
And fierce in itself. Nicholas, thank you for your call. We've got another break coming up. So much to talk about. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the roadmap to peace and realities on the ground in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with Israeli journalist and historian Tom Segev. Has war in Iraq really changed the terms of this conversation? Where does your hope lie in this conflict? What's the heart of your despair? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the roadmap to peace and realities on the ground in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with eminent Israeli journalist and historian Tom Segev. His books have given me quite an education. I can't recommend them highly enough. If you want one to start with One Palestine, Complete Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate. You are welcome into this conversation tonight. Tom Segev writes that this peace will take many years. Does the world have years to spare for this conflict? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tarif is calling from Dulles, Virginia. Hi, Tarif. You're on the air.
Hi, both of you. Tom Segev, I enjoy reading what you write in Haaretz.
Thank you.
I don't think the world can wait with the advent of international terror and the specter of terrorists gaining weapons of mass destruction one way or the other. I think that the world cannot wait for a solution here, certainly not decades. And I want to just bring the argument down to, well, what should the United States do? Clearly here we do have a roadmap, a peace plan that's put forward. It's got its shortcomings, but it's there. It's the only one in town. And one side has accepted it, the other hasn't. The president of the United States has to pressure Sharon to accept it. The problem for President Bush is the influences here in the United States. It used to be that we would talk about the Jewish lobby in the United States, but today that is surpassed by the Christian Zionist lobby in the United States.
The kind of fundamentalist Christian move to support Israel.
60 million strong. I wonder if you would, Tom Segev, if you would comment on how the Christian Zionist element in the United States is viewed in Israel and the pressure that it brings to bear on the Bush administration.
Tarif, thanks very much for your call. Tom Segev.
I just want to say that it's important to distinguish between the government of Israel and the state of Israel. And when you say that you're pro-Israeli, you're not necessarily pro-Israeli by supporting the present government or any government. And if you criticize the policies of a certain government, you're not necessarily anti-Israeli. On the contrary, you may be very anti-Sharon because you are very pro-Israeli.
Duly noted.
Okay. So, and I think that when I travel around the United States, I really find many different opinions and many different views, and I think that these Christians are entitled to their views. I don't really share it, but they are entitled to their view. But I do very often find people who say, well, this is anti-Israeli, or the anti-Israeli press, or the anti-Israeli radio, or whatever. And it's not anti-Israeli. It's really criticizing certain actions of the certain positions of the Israeli government, which I think is very, very legitimate.
And what about the issue of U.S. leverage? We hear a lot about it, but I'm not sure how much of it we see. There has been leverage, enough leverage on the Palestinian side to produce a new prime minister.
That's right. It doesn't seem that President Bush is really interested to put a lot of pressure on Israel. And I think that's rather unfortunate. As I said, I think that the United States should really put pressure on both sides and be much deeper involved. A telephone conversation is not enough.
But paint a picture of that, Tom Segev. Let's say, just imagine, and it's kind of unimaginable, but if Washington in 2003 brought everything it had to bear mm-hmm. in terms of engagement and leverage and pressure on both sides mm-hmm. in this setting, given the earlier kind of dour view that we heard from you, how much could really be accomplished if everything was brought onto the table?
You need a lot of pressure in order to take the first steps. And once you take the first steps, you don't really solve the conflict. You just create the background for a life which may be livable for a number of years, and then you go to the next step.
But with maximum pressure from the U.S., for example, could the timetable of the roadmap be met? Provisional state by what, this year? Real state by 2005? You're shaking your head no.
Because you really want to hold on to the optimistic version of Saeb Erekat, and you know.
Well, I don't know if it's his, but we've had the daylight scared out of us by events, and we'd like to solve this. And we've had many Israelis and Palestinians say on this show, "Help us! We can't do it ourselves."
I know you have to end the show on an optimistic note because that's the way it's done in America. But
I don't think it's that simple. But we would like to, you know, push ahead here.
I know. I really think that what we need is a lot of pressure in order to do things which can be done immediately, such as dismantling of isolated settlements, for example, and what is perhaps easier to do, to ease on the human rights violations, which is really very, very harmful to the whole situation. Because, as I said before, we are really breeding a new generation of terrorists here. And if you ever been to Israel and if you saw how people are being harassed at the roadblocks, and that's a very, very simple thing. That's not even
just moving around, living.
The major violation. But I mean, this is really making it very, very hard on them. Mm. And that's something we can change.
Gennady's calling from Boston. Hi, Gennady. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I have a question for the Mr. Segev.
Yes.
He just said right now that one of the problems between Israeli and Palestinians is the treatment of Palestinians by Israel, especially harassment on the checkpoint. I understand this.
Okay.
I'd like him to comment on how the Palestinians are treated in the countries of the settlement, like, for example, in Syria and Lebanon, compared to the Israel, for example, in Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, whatever.
Gennady, are you suggesting that Palestinians are better treated in the West Bank than they are in...
No, I'm just asking to compare.
All right.
I'm not really familiar with that. I would think that at times they are being treated very badly, and in, for example, in Kuwait during the war of Iraq, they were treated very badly. But As an Israeli, I don't really care about that. I really care what is done in my name, not what's done in other countries.
Joan's calling from Milwaukee. Joan, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm calling because I've been following this issue for many years, mm-hmm. and my main source of information, I must admit, is the New York Times.
All right.
But the after reading and watching, I feel that if this roadmap for peace, if the fanatics, like on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side, they knew no matter what they did, like Sharon builds a wall and then cuts down all the orchards so that he can see the terrorists come, and then that
yeah, so where are you taking this, Joan?
What I'm taking this is, I think if it were made, I mean, if they knew, like, say tomorrow, there'd be another suicide bomber, and mm-hmm. the next day Sharon would, kill the suicide bomber's family and mow down 20 houses, mm-hmm. and in between a couple kids got shot. But not to let this stop the process. It seems to me this is what stops it.
But Joan, how do you ignore these things? I mean, when those bombs go off, when the bulldozers run, people die. Could that be ignored?
I don't mean to ignore them. I mean to those people, I don't think really want peace. I think that's why they, from either side.
That's fair enough. Joan, let me put it to Tom Sigev.
I can help you with the formulation. We mm-hmm. really should go ahead with measures that ease the tension as if there's no terrorism, and we have to fight terrorism as if we are not doing these measures of easing tension.
So you're agreeing with Joan? Separate these
Joan.
Things.
I think that we should really, as I said before, not let these fanatics dictate the whole Middle East agenda.
But this has hardly been the Sharon way.
It is very, very difficult. This is not the Sharon way. Well,
Well, he's just been elected by a pretty strong
by
margin.
By a very small, by a very big majority of Israelis. And the reason why he was elected, I think, is not because people support his policy, but because they wanted to punish the Palestinians. And because people are fed up with terrorism, they voted. It's a completely irrational vote. They vote with anger and with fear and very often with hate. They did not really think rationally what's the best thing for Israel. And I can perfectly understand that because, as I said before, this is the terrorism. This is what terrorism does to rational democratic countries, and has done that to other countries, including to some extent to this country. And this is the real danger of terrorism, that it diminishes the willingness and ability of people to think rationally.
So you're saying don't let it be driven by the extremists. Tom Sagan, we don't get you here in town often, and we're awfully glad to have you. You are skeptical of American enthusiasm for a timetable and let's get it done and that kind of optimism. So give us your deepest, most heartfelt advice. We know that Washington has sway here. How should it be used?
I think that we need a U.S. president who gets personally involved in the conflict. The conflict needs it. I'm not sure if the United
president
States
needs it.
The president may not
We
need
had
it.
That before. It didn't work.
Right. It didn't work because mistakes were made, which I think can be analyzed and must not be repeated. It was mismanaged, but it was still a good thing. We need an American president to get involved. We need pressure put on Israel to take certain measures. And on the Palestinians as well. I think that we need the European Union to move in and, as I said, possibly open the door for Israel to join the European Union as a full member. And that would give the Israelis at least some hope. And the Palestinians need some form of statehood as early as possible, not as the end of the negotiation process, but at the beginning of the negotiation
process.
We've
got 30 seconds. You're an historian and a good one. We hear we hear so much in your voice tonight. Do you have hope
that ultimately there will be two states side by side? Yes, looking at the history, I think I have hope because we did come closer, the two sides. There was a time when the Palestinians wouldn't even recognize our existence, and we said we will never ever negotiate with the Palestinians, and that changed.
Tom Segev, it's a privilege to have you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Tom Segev is a columnist for the Israeli daily Haaretz. He is author of One Palestine Complete and Elvis in Jerusalem, Post-Zionism and the Americanization of Israel. You can continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the president of Israel's Supreme Court on the importance of the rule of law in the battle against terrorism. This is On Point. In the wake of the latest wave of suicide bombings, the president of Israel's Supreme Court says it is essential for democracies to respect civil rights and the rule of law when going after terrorists. Aharon Barak was the commencement speaker at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts, on Sunday. He said democracy cannot exist without the protection of individual human rights, rights so essential that they must be insulated from the power of the majority. He spoke to the class of 2003. Here are excerpts from his speech.
The rule of law and democracy must prevail in times of peace. They must also prevail in times of war and terror. The Roman saying that in battle the laws are silent, or the well-known saying that when the cannons speak, the muses are silent, is wrong, absolutely wrong. Every battle a country wages against terrorism or any other enemy is done according to rules and laws. There is always law according to which a state must act. There are no black holes, and the law needs muses ever more urgently than when the cannons speak. We need laws most in times of war, and we need human rights most in times of war and fight against terror. Yes, when a democracy fights terror, not all means are acceptable to it, and not all methods employed by its enemies are open to it. Sometimes a democracy must fight with one hand tied behind its back. Nonetheless, it has the upper hand. Preserving the rule of law and recognition of individual liberties constitute an important component of its understanding and security. At the end of the day, to strengthen its spirit and to allow it to overcome its difficulties. So in the United States after September 11, and so in my country, Israel, where we are suffering from terrorism for a long time. My life teaches me that one must fight for democracy and the rule of law. Democracy and the rule of law cannot be taken for granted. Strong internal and external forces conspire against it. The approach that it cannot happen to us can no longer be accepted. Anything can happen. If democracy was perverted and destroyed in the Germany of Kant, Beethoven, and Goethe, it can happen anywhere. If we do not protect democracy, democracy will not protect us.
Aharon Barak, president of Israel's Supreme Court, delivering the commencement address at Brandeis University on Sunday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by